Welcome back, everybody, to another extravaganza that we call the Be Better Podcast. I'm here with a pitcher snapping Devin. He always takes some very keen social media pictures here, documenting our journey through conversation and sport. Would you call it that?
No, your dog's sitting on my lap.
Oh, you took a picture of my dog. I thought you were taking a picture of me.
No.
Never mind. Okay. That was very, very arrogant of me to assume that. We are back for the Be Better Podcast. And you know what? I am so excited. There's some really cool things that you and I have chatted about offline that we're going to talk about today. But also, we've got a couple of things that we need before we get to those topics that we need to kind of hash over. Two important triathlon-related elements. One is going to be the recent Oceanside 70.3 event.
Yes.
And kind of getting your take on some of the events that happened around that, the event itself, the results.
Okay.
I'm not sure how ingrained you are with the results of that race, but I will feed them to you if necessary here today.
You will be feeding me those results.
All right. So, and I didn't give you any of this information for you to prep on at all beforehand. So Devin, the 70.3 Oceanside race, have you ever raced that one before?
I never made it out for that. There was no incentive. Even 10, 15 years ago, it was like a bastion of the spring season. So it was way too competitive back then. So there would have been it just would have been a lot of money spent to get a real beatdown.
Yeah, and a unique event in and of itself. Ocean swim, kind of a mountain-esque bike ride going through a U.S. military base through Camp Pendleton.
Because it's always been a tough-ish bike, right?
It's always been a tough-ish bike.
Have you done it yourself?
No, I've been to Camp Pendleton. Back in the day, I did SWAT training in Camp Pendleton back when Chris the Cop was in existence. I did a week of SWAT training with the Los Angeles Police Department D Platoon. Interesting enough, it was about a month after the big L.A. Bank robbery shootout. Remember when the two guys went in with machine guns and full body armor?
How old are you?
I am older than you expected.
Whoa.
Were you in alive when that happened, maybe?
Wow.
I know. So that was when you remember the incident, though. The guys came out in full body armor. They had the full shootout in the middle of the street, walking down the street.
Isn't that what the movie Heat is based on?
It wasn't based on that, but Heat is very close to what that was. It was a full-on, like, machine gun shootout in the neighborhoods. And I've actually been to that area, and back in the day when I did my second triathlon in Hemet, California, did a practice run or a training run through that neighborhood where the bullet marks were still on the walls of the building. Crazy. Anyways, so that's Oceanside.
Hey,
that's Oceanside. So Camp Pendleton. So this year, it's a great race. I've actually done it a number of times on the CompuTrainer back in the day when they had the real live things and kind of riding through there. But going through the military base, you have to get special clearance. And there also is a very unique aspect to that race where there are specific speed limits that are set for athletes. You cannot go over a specific speed limit in certain areas. Did you know that?
Are we talking descents or flats?
We're talking flat areas.
Okay.
But the speed limit is 25 miles an hour. And so if you go over that, you can be disqualified.
Okay.
Did you know that this year there were disqualifications for that?
Is this the first time they've enforced that?
It's the first time it's been that the disqualifications were overturned. But yes, there were athletes that were given penalties. One was a race car driver who has been put on the circuit, and I am doing the search here, but he was actually given a speeding ticket for going over 25 miles an hour. How would you feel about triathlons that are enforcing road rules? Is enforcing speed limits, now outside of the fact that this probably is the only way they could have this race there, is that I'm sure that permits made it be that you had to, and you could not go faster for some reason. If you had to come to a complete and full stop at, let's say, a semaphore, would that be a deal breaker? Would that be a reason for you as a pro to say, I'm not going to do this race because I'm regulated to too much extent.
It gets dicey because what if you say, I am going to follow the letter of the rules, and you know full well a large portion of the field won't be.
Yeah.
So because do you go in knowing you might be, by following the rules, you may be at a competitive disadvantage? Are you comfortable with that?
Well, I mean, can you say competitive disadvantage by following the rules? Because if you're not following the rules, you're technically cheating, right?
Yeah.
So then are you competitive? Are you competitive if you're cheating? Do you see where I'm going with that?
Yep.
That's a box I just put you in right there.
Yep.
See this? This is a square box that Devin is now sitting inside of.
If you're a bike guy and you need all of the advantage you can get from the ride, but let's just say it's X number of miles are neutralized where you're maxing out at 25 and a half of that nature on a flat course, those guys would be averaging probably 26 to 30.
Mm-hmm.
You're neutralizing part of your advantage. So even if everyone played by the rules and then knowing that some people won't, or maybe some people just will get, they'll break the rule and get away with it.
Yep.
But it's that way with draft. It's that way with a lot of the rules in the sport. There's
yep.
plenty of people who are drafting out there. We talked about it a few episodes ago with the yellow line enforcement.
Yep. And the new pods that the PTO is using, those proximity mm-hmm. pods, which were supposed to be used at Oceanside this year.
But we're not
because of technical difficulties and glitches that were incurred in the pre-testing before the event. So they were not used this year. But the intent is to take that technology and move it forward into the WTC and the 70.3 series. And from what I understand, also the full Ironman.
I would not seek out a race if there were complications like that, where it's like, you got a speed limit on this point in this portion. I maybe wouldn't seek that out. But if you were going there just for the experience, I don't know. Or if you're a phenomenal runner, you would go do it. Did I mention in Lake Stevens 70.3 in 2010, I ran into not a speed limit, but I ran into just a regular motorist on the road. I got caught behind him. They were going, it was the second loop, so they're stuck in slower age group traffic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm caught behind them. I had just broken away from the main field.
Ooh.
And I was a coward at that time, so I just tucked in and was like, and I just stayed behind when I probably, if I had been more aggressive, would have just crossed the yellow line, passed the vehicle, and just gone for it.
Yep.
So that would have been the bold play, but I was not bold enough at that time.
Well, you
know. So I've bumped into these things and...
And kind of went around. It's an interesting question because there are, you know, like you say, neutralized areas of other sports. You think about NASCAR, you know, going in and out of the pits, you're neutralized. You don't get to go full gas at certain areas. And it is part of the race. I think it's interesting. One of the people that were dinged and initially DQ'd, but then brought back on the results. One was Lionel Sanders.
Oh,
yeah.
The DQ and then overturning of a DQ is a weird process.
It is. It was on appeal, and there it's still a hot button issue because the race was this past weekend. But looking at the results, Lionel Sanders was the overall winner.
So they DQ'd their champ and then reinstated him.
Reinstated back.
Think about that emotional roller coaster.
I know. Well, and you know, Lionel had a great race. So just to feed you some data points for. His swim was 24:36, which was 24th overall. His bike was a 2:06.11 for a second overall result, and his run was a 1:10.40 for a third overall result. Overall time 3:46.24, winning him how much?
$5,000, $10,000,
$7,500. What you think about it, Lionel Sanders? It's like that's not a lot of money for that much work. But to give Ironman some props, the money went eight deep, so it went down. Eighth place got $1,000,
yep,
which doesn't even cover the hotel.
Nope.
But it went the same money equally, men and women.
It always has.
Which is, I just say that, you know, because there has been some disparity, and there's like,
yep.
I'm glad that it did. But eight deep, that's pretty good for a 70.3.
Well,
how many pro men were in the field, Devin, that were vying for that money?
50? 60?
63 finished.
Oof.
And you had 63, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You had 70 male pros.
What was the ninth place time, Chris?
Ninth place time overall was a time of 3:57.41.
So you could be a sub 4 hour on a hard course and get $0 for the effort.
Yep. The first person to go over the 4 hour mark was number 15. That was Andre Lopes from Brazil.
Sorry, Andre.
I know. So, I mean, again, it's like in Kona the other 2 years ago, where the course record was broken by the first three guys.
It's getting faster out there.
I know. That's a course record, though. That's not just going sub eight. That's a course record. No.
I don't want to sound like a wimp that I wouldn't target a really competitive event, but for me, when I was racing pro, I wanted to at least target an event where I had a better shot because I was realistic enough. You know, I'm not a 3:46 guy. My best was a 4:01.
Yeah.
You know, so to go to spend the money to do, you know, a pretty expensive trip to California and then have zero likelihood of even sneaking in, it just, I probably wouldn't have pulled the trigger.
And to put it in perspective as well, how deep? So 43rd overall, went 4:16. So like it was like people coming in pretty fast and regular. It was pretty tight there. But the 43rd person overall, Chris Hammer. Now, you may not understand. You may not know that name, but Chris Hammer is a Paralympic athlete that is going to be competing in the Paris Olympics.
All right. So this is part of his buildup. He worked it in
absolutely.
His program.
Cool. Yeah. So Chris's impairment is he is missing one of his hands.
Okay.
So in the swim, it's an impairment there, but he is a wicked fast runner and a super fast biker.
Okay.
So making up that disparity, but 43rd overall, but that amount of time, like how close that was.
And that's just, half hour.
Mm-hmm. Less than half hour. Crazy. Half hour. Crazy.
Okay. So you said Lionel rode 2:06. I want to say in the early 2010s, the champs were riding in the high teens. Like it was a big deal if you went under 2:20.
Yeah. So Chris rode a 2:21.
Okay.
Swam a 29. So that's his where he came back, but ran a 1:18. Now 1:18, you're thinking, well, okay, well that's pretty bad. But eighth place, Justin Reel ran a 1:19.
What Justin ride?
He rode a 2:07.
There you go.
And you know, and so in looking at this at the efforts here, so Sam Long was second. So Sam went 25:36 in the swim. So he went 1 minute slower, but he rode a 2:05.45, which is about only 30 seconds faster, but ran about 90 seconds slower. So he came in at 3:47.35, a little bit more than a minute back in second place. So at some point he was competitive, but then got outrun.
Yeah.
So an interesting race. On the women's side, do you know who won the women's race?
I do not. Do you care to tell me?
I'm going to give you some hints and see if you can pull it out of the air.
Taylor Nibb.
Yes! Nibsy took the win. And, you know, does this solidify her steps and progression more towards being
greatest of all time?
The GOAT? I don't know.
She won the California 70.3 greatest
of all
time.
Hey, you know what? I tell you, she swam 25:25.
Yep.
Biked a 2:18 and then ran a 1:20.15 for a 4:09.55. Second place, Emma Pallant Brown from the wonderful Federation of Great Britain. What was her, how far back was she?
I would guess 5 minutes.
More.
Eight?
11.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was a pretty hard thing. So Nibsy went second in the swim, 25:25. The 2:18 was the first on the bike. But ironically, Emma went first in the run at a 1:18.41. So.
Because if you can do 10, 12, 14 minutes of damage on the bike and still hold together a 1:20.
Oh, yeah. Tell you.
Yeah. No, you can. Yeah. You clawed back 2 minutes. Good job. But
that's what the goat does.
That's what goats do.
That's what goats do. That's what goats do. So an interesting race across the board. Some very familiar faces again that we're seeing in that 70.3. And we should see them kind of continue not only in the 70.3 series and the full Ironman series, but also continue through the PTO series as well this year.
Well, how I'm kind of, I'll give Lionel a lot of credit for longevity at this stage, because he was just coming to world-class prominence as I was wrapping up my career. I feel like 2014, 2015 is when
I was going to say 2006, you were wrapping up your career.
Hey, hey, you're 70 years old. Hey, you were just claiming of being...
Don't hate, because those art benefits are great. My Denny's is half the cost of yours.
Lionel, I remember Lionel had a fantastic duel with Jan Frodeno at this race when he was just clawing into prominence, and yep, he posted his power numbers. I accused him of doping because of the posted power numbers. I was like,
on Twitter?
BS, can you average 370 for a half and then run 113 off of that? I just thought it was... Because the performance level was so...
You're a non-believer, Devin, and at your core, you're a non-believer.
I'm a skeptic and a hater, and it was like, it was, frankly, the numbers were so much better than mine, I couldn't grapple with it.
And I think if you put all those terms together, it equals troll.
Troll. Troll.
So, I mean, but I think it goes to show, I don't think, thinking back, I think Lionel has retired from the full Ironman distance.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, and that he is focusing on 70.3. I think I read that he was not going to be focusing on Kona anymore, and he was just going to be 70.3 money, which is, you know, hey, you know your role, because now 70.3 and the PTO have a pretty good series, and he's been doing well enough there that he can focus on that one. Unlike the GOAT, who is, you know, doing it all.
Yeah.
Olympics. 70.3,
the
full Ironman. I'm telling you, you watch, man. Lionel. You watch. No, not Lionel. Lionel's not the GOAT.
No, I know, but it's impressive to me that a decade later, he's still performing at this level, still pulling off wins.
100%. And you see that more with men than you do with women. I'm not sure exactly why.
Yeah.
Although there have been exceptions to the rule, like a Natasha Bodman. Definitely was one who
she was world class
for a long year, and you know, you don't see it as often now.
Yeah,
many women kind of retire and go into other things, or just kind of bow out, like Chrissy Wellington.
Yep,
just said, you know what, I want it all, and no, I've got nothing else to prove, and I'm gonna do other things.
She really went out on top.
Of course she did. To her honor, she didn't come back and try and say, let's have a victory lap.
Yep,
she didn't do a Lance. She didn't do like a Jordan,
Chris Froome,
Wayne Gretzky, yep, which, you know, it's like, oh, I'm going to come back again. Like, no, let's just make this pure.
Stay out.
Let's make this pure. And she's, you know, she tapped out. Chrissy in, Chrissy out. Now, the next race that's coming up that these guys are all going to be vying for is the PTO or the T100 race in Singapore.
T100.
Because T100 is kind of like their thing. Now, 100 is not miles, 100 is kilometers. And this is a race that probably the closest you ever came was the Tri 101 race, right?
No, the TriStar 111 series. The illustrious and short-lived TriStar 111.
111. And you went head-to-head with a big name there, didn't you?
Christopher McCormick. Oh, maybe yeah, you've heard of him.
Macca? Yeah, Macca. I still have that book that was that I had to pay for, which we'll not talk about there. That was I came to, yeah, that was there. So for those that don't know, the T100 series is a 100 kilometer course, 2 kilometer swim, which is one lap, 80 kilometer bike, which is 8 laps in a draft legal style format, but not draft legal, because that's why the multiple laps are there, and that's where they use those proximity meters, and then a 3 lap run of a total of 18 kilometers. So, but the big hubbubaloo here, and I got this through my my level 3 coaching called yesterday that I had with other coaches, is that
your gossip sesh.
Gossip sesh through coaches is that a bunch of pro men are whining about how hot it's going to be. Now I Googled what the temperatures are going to be. It's going to be high in the 90s. It's a high of 90 for this weekend in Singapore. But
what are we talking for humidity? I'm picturing
it didn't
high
show
humidity.
Me that. It's okay. Probably high humidity. So let's say high humidity, high of 90. Now, the thing that I posed to the group yesterday was, are pros getting soft? Because how many years did we see other things like this happen, like a Lanzarote, you know, people racing in Kona, because it's normally like hot as Hades in Kona too, high wind, high humidity, those type of things. Are pros these days getting too soft, expecting too much of the perfect weather scenario?
What riddled me this, Google exists. When I was planning my race calendar, I wasn't going to do an expensive trip to a competitive field where I'm just going to get housed and get 50th. And I wasn't going to go to a blazing hot venue because I'm a Minnesotan.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a nice 60s, 70s day. So I would target events. You can do the research ahead of time. It's Singapore.
It's going to be hot.
What are we complaining about here?
Yeah, I know.
Don't go.
That's what I said. It's like, if you just plan on not going. But the fact that they're complaining about it being too hot, should they even run the race at 90? Yeah. What do? You back it down a little bit, you hydrate more, and you just mitigate your energy expenditure so that you don't overheat.
Kona has always been a certain set of conditions.
Yeah.
I'm not understanding any frustration on their end. If I would understand frustration, you understand frustration, like if you go to a travel event and things change last second, like, oh, it was,
yes,
surf was wrong, so we had to cancel the swim, so it changes the race dynamic.
Yeah.
Potentially you lost money as a result of that. Okay, you can make the argument for being frustrated. It's Singapore.
Yeah.
What did you think it would be?
It's going to be hot. I mean, there are times when you could go to a race when it can be canceled for tsunamis, things that you can't, like, yep, you know, things you can't control or predict many times. But if you know it's going to be hot, just either prepare for it, shut up, or just, you know, don't go.
Well, yeah, there's training. You can do preparation in your training and then you execute a certain way. You can't go and do your previous race plan as if it were 60 degrees.
No. You have to adjust. And I think that's part of, you know, but as a coach, what do you do? How do you mitigate that?
You're accusing these beautiful, strong, professional athletes of whining.
100%.
Why? What is your source that they are complaining? Who are you hearing this from?
I'm hearing it from their coaches.
So their coaches are
saying...
Their
coaches are saying that they're complaining it's too hot. It's going to be too hot there.
Let's name names.
No. I am not willing to go down there.
Break the circle of confidentiality.
I am not willing to go there. I can say that that I have spoken to their coaches who brought this out, and we had the same discussion. I brought this up to their coach. Are professional triathletes these days getting soft? Are they expecting too much? Instead of going out and gritting it out and saying, okay, I'm going to put my nose to the grindstone. I'm actually going to lean into the worst conditions to consider myself a better athlete. If I can compete in the hardest, harshest conditions, like I'm talking like the extreme cold of Norseman all the way to the, let's say, extreme heat of the Canary Islands and Lanzarote. Mm-hmm. If I can win that, I'm a better athlete than somebody who's just going for a middle ground, let's say, in racing in Kansas.
I don't understand any frustration. It's like you execute a certain way. You run. It's an element of the race. It's like a hill in the race. It's like this is a piece of the challenge, and I approach it a certain way, and this is how I overcome it.
So you'd be frustrated with an athlete that came to you, if you were a coach, and said, oh, it's just going to be so hot there. They aren't allowing pillows in transition.
I just don't.
I don't know. The water's going to be warm.
When it's...
Yeah. Yep. I'd say it just... I think it's just a bad thing. Speaking of conditions changing, mm-hmm, recently, as of yesterday, NBC News reporting that a group in Paris is reporting conditions in the Seine having human fecal matter to the point where the water is going to be so contaminated they're not going to be able to have the triathlon swim. This is NBC News saying human fecal matter,
yep,
Seine River,
yep,
no triathlon swim for the Paris Games. Not that they're not going to have it, because they could, you know, it still has time, but as an athlete, how would you feel if you're starting to hear some of these things? Knowing that, number one, it's the Olympics,
yep,
but two, that's kind of an extreme measure of pollution.
Yeah.
Would you still say, F it, it's the Olympics and you got to do what you got to do?
I would think someone who is truly in the headspace of, I'm that world class and I'm going to be a gold medalist, there's going to be a contingent within the Olympic competitors who are there to win and they're uncompromising champions.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to do whatever.
Yep.
They go through Chernobyl to win.
Yep.
Right? So irregardless, irrespective of danger and or risk, or they're going to do it.
Yes.
I think there's going to be others that are, if you have maybe a softer mindset, whatever you want to say, a more anxious personality, you might start thinking, oh, are they going to cancel? It might become a fixation and you start worrying about it. And then there's people who might just say, well, I'm not swimming in a stinky river.
Yeah. And the water conditions are not unique to just this Olympiad. Yep. Tokyo, the water was very warm. And that was an issue. The test event was actually canceled, turned into duathlon. The test event in Paris turned into duathlon this year.
Yep.
So those are things that are realities. There's also the reality of pre-Olympic media buzz. Wild roaming packs of dogs in Sochi, that was going to impact, you know, many different things. They're going to be running onto the hills and things. All these things come out. But definitely something we want to be keeping track of, listening for, and seeing, because if they do change the Olympics into a duathlon, that changes, number one, who your selections are, because if you're selecting based upon triathlon and you end up having a duathlon, that's going to change who your team will want to be. So from a federation standpoint, they're going to be wanting to know if this is a reality possibility. Also, I'm sure everything inside the Olympics in Paris, they're going to do whatever they can, short of chlorinating the Seine, to make sure that river is going to be clean.
Yeah.
I mean, hey, the Chinese moved all their homeless people into the hill country, so it wasn't smoggy for Beijing.
You would expect the host city to really do a lot to move mountains to make it happen. You would want to think like, oh, if I were in the running to go, I would be one of the hard-headed people. I'm not letting it affect my mentality. I don't think you can.
You got to let it be.
But you'd have to think some of the athletes will be affected by it.
It's going to be a psych out matter. Yep. I mean, if you're preparing, you can't think about it. That's too much micromanagement. And that's one of the reasons I think many athletes that I've spoken to and worked with that do prepare for the Olympics and Paralympics really isolate themselves from social media in the months prior to, because they can't get into the minutiae of that.
It's a lesson for all of us.
Oh, absolutely.
Even in my world of real estate now, I have to be very careful what kind of content I'm seeing or observing, so it doesn't distract me or make me feel some kind of way or take me off my purpose.
Like the federal law, like lawsuits being settled against
blinders
against
on
industry.
Blinders on. Did I just lose a $418 million lawsuit? I sure did. Blinders on.
Exactly. No. So of some very interesting things coming up in that time ahead. Now that moves us into Devin.
If we're talking about poopy water, allow me, sir, to tell you about Challenge Aarhus, the half Ironman I did in Aarhus, Denmark in 2011. I happened to be in Scandinavia for my buddy Jorgen's wedding. He's Norwegian. I was in Norway for a month.
Jorgen's Norwegian? I
never would have. Who would have thought?
I've met Jorgen. Very nice kid.
He is very nice. He's not a kid. He's got three kids.
Well, now he does. Yep. He was a nice kid then.
We drive down to Denmark. Very rainy leading into race day.
Okay.
Flushes out
Ooh.
A lot of the storm sewers and such
into
the bay. Pretty stinky.
Mm-hmm.
You know, didn't overthink it. I didn't even think twice about it. Didn't overthink it. This was 2011. For some reason, this was the era of the white tri-suit in Europe.
Oh, no.
Those were the thing.
Oh, no.
So all you had to do as a benchmark of water quality was see the white tri-suits coming out of that swim. Jorgen, when we were at the pool a week or two later, was putting his goggles on. He hadn't washed or rinsed his goggles since the event. As part of his little pre-swim routine, he likes to lick the inside of his goggles, and he licked it and looked over at me like,
"Oh, there's a turd sickle sandwich there."
We swam through quite a bit of Danish poop.
Oh, my goodness.
Neither of us got sick.
But no floaters. You didn't see anything floating. No corn in your hair.
You know, but we're millennials. We have strong constitutions. These pros now, these Gen Z pros, they're soft. Us tough old school millennials.
Oh, there we are. Millennial tough.
It's great, Chris. It's so great because us millennials were maligned for so long. And now everyone is piling on the Gen Zs. Whether it's justified or not, they're really getting it.
You just got to outlive them. And there's going to be somebody below you that's going to be a lot softer, but you're making the same complaints against them that people above you, like me,
made
towards you.
Boomers and millennials, there's been a lot of cultural strife. You know who flies under the radar?
Hmm.
The one generation that never accomplished anything or contributed anything to society.
If you
Gen
say,
X.
You can just suck it, Palmer. We accomplished
the
everything.
One generation.
We are laying the foundation for your life right now.
I've been scratching my head like, boy, there's so much strength.
Who
between,
brought the internet in? We did.
Between
who
boomers and millennials, we really go at it.
We brought to you Nirvana. We brought to you Guns N' Roses. We brought all that to you.
Nothing. You've accomplished. You've done
the bike
nothing.
Computer was brought to you. GPS was brought in our terms.
You'll do nothing. You've done nothing. You'll leave no mark in history.
Gen X.
Shout out Gen X.
All right. Just go rent the movie Singles or download it from Netflix. Go to
keep
Blockbuster.
Trying with your cultural references.
Go to Blockbuster and get the movie Singles, and you'll see exactly why Gen X is so superior to everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We brought coffee houses into the mainstream, my friend. We gave you terms you will never, ever probably use again, but you'll never live out. You know, barista. Barista. That's right. That's a Gen X term. Barista. Okay. All right, whatever. All right, so let's pivot to another topic that you and I have been chuckling about in the backside recently, coaching.
Coaching.
So you
are. Let's just review. You have your own coaching business.
Yep.
Final Case Boarding Services.
Yep.
You're USAT accredited, and you're a level
3
out of 10.
I think there's like 26 of us in the world.
No, but there's 26 levels.
So you're, no, there's you're level 3
levels. Oh wait, you're the top. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yep. As a Gen Xer, I have reached the
zenith. You're at your professional peak. Yeah,
everything's downhill from here.
Yeah. And you've been involved in coaching education. You've been out for all manner of trainings. I got my undergrad in kinesiology with a minor in coaching, and I got my master's of education in sport and exercise science. So we cared enough about it to try and be good, right?
So we've set the baseline that we both kind of know what we're talking about.
Yep.
Right, we've gone the route, we've gone the rules, and we've done the education bit. So there is, definitely a differential in coaching these days than there has been in the past. As an ex-pro, you went down the one path, which was taking a pro career,
yep,
and trying to maximize your name recognition and your palmares, your results. To say, okay, I'm gonna pivot to take that and tell people, okay, I won all these races. You want to be like me?
Yep.
I'm gonna be your coach.
There was an extremely consistent pattern, especially, I mean, it was clear as day in my era. The pros of my tier who were not earning almost anything and certainly not a subsistence income from being a pro, people would be a fast amateur, go pro the next year, and within 18 months or 2 years, hang their shingle as a coach.
Yep.
It was clear as day. It happened all the time. Some of us took it seriously. Like, I happened to be on that path already. I had just been finishing my time at university.
At university? What are you, Canadian?
At university. Well, it was the University of Minnesota. It was a university.
A college.
I was wrapping up, so I didn't feel like, oh, I'm not just taking advantage of my name, because it's like, oh, I have some level of background in this and I care about it.
Fastest bike at national championships as an amateur.
I'll teach third
overall.
My 3 life hacks to have the fastest.
While wearing
a
Kathy Innocent suit, which probably gave you just a little extra speed.
Gave me that edge. You know, so I never felt guilt about drifting into coaching because it had always been part of my mission anyways. But in my time as a pro, I wasn't living off pro money because there was almost none to be made.
No.
I was living a subsistence income off some coaching.
Yep.
And so it was always funny to see the rogues like, oh, you have no back. You barely even gotten USAT. And some even wouldn't get USAT certified. And they would say, oh, I'm a coach. And just seeing the marketing, it was always pretty brutal.
Yeah, and a lot of those, we've seen those pros that have done it. I mean, if you're a famous pro, it's an easy transition, right?
Yeah.
We saw Maka do it. We saw Crowe do it. I think like Leanda even had dipped her her pen in
Mark
the
Allen,
coaching.
Dave Mark Scott.
All those guys have done that, and you know, a lot of them have I would say the palmares to back that up. Like, okay, I was a world champion multiple times.
Yep.
I have won a number of races. But we're seeing now some people are coming out and saying, I'm just going to be a coach and I don't have, what do I have for certification?
Yep.
What do I have for experience? And I'm not saying that you have to win in order to be a good coach, because Lord knows I didn't win anything. Although I did win my age group a couple of times in little itty bitty races. I got a couple trophies downstairs to show that. But that, I think it's a misnomer to say that you have to be good in order to be a good coach. Or if you are good, you are a good coach.
Yep. Not at all a clean correlation. Mentally, people do correlate being fast and being a good coach.
Yeah, which is unfortunate.
Yep.
Because, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of examples where that hasn't worked out. Lance Armstrong, terrible coach. Wayne Gretzky tried coaching hockey, terrible coach. Michael Jordan tried coaching basketball, terrible coach, yep. Right? Doesn't mean just because you're the GOAT in one sport doesn't mean you're going to translate.
One of my very best friends, CJ, was the fastest breaststroker at our high school. So he set the school record in the 100 breast. And, you know, when I was coaching the high school team a couple years later, I brought him back like, oh, talk to the breaststrokers and give them some advice.
Mm-hmm.
I realized it was the starkest picture of why gifted athletes aren't always a good coach. He was looking down at them there in the water, he looking up, and he says, just go faster.
It's like, yeah, better?
You were good off ability. You know, some people who had to be more conscientious and, you know, like I think of a Crowley as, okay, I would trust Crowley more as a coach because he was very conscientious in his progression of his career.
Yep.
Seems like he had a lot of ability, but to maximize, he was very thoughtful in his path.
Yes. And you could parallel that to like a Dave Scott or a Mark Allen who basically had to figure out things on their own.
Pioneers.
Yeah, the pioneers. So they had to figure out, and they had to figure out how to make that road. The problem becomes, I think, is when you have pros that transition, and it's almost seemed as like a fallback money grab.
Yep.
Like, well, okay.
And that's what
that's
what I'm describing is the second year in your as a pro, you realize there's nothing here for me money wise.
And so I'm just gonna I'm gonna see if I can grab some easy money, and that's frustrating for me, right? Because I feel like you have to, you know, number one, you have to be in it for the right reasons as a coach. It's not easy at all. I've run into many pitfalls where it's life has been incredibly difficult. And also it's what you do kind of also is related to the perception of all other coaches.
Well, it denigrates the profession when there's no barrier to entry.
Yeah.
It means,
and there are barriers to entry, which you could hold yourself to, but it's like, it would be nice if it was, if you know, so let me ask this. If I want to sell a house, do I have to be a realtor?
You could go sell your house on Facebook right now. But if you want to become a realtor, is that a hard barrier to entry? It certainly is not.
No.
Hold a license for $2,000-$3,000 a year. You got to do X hours of training, pass a couple of tests. I would say it's very similar in my profession where it's a very, very low bar. And the low-skill, low-value agents, everyone has a bad story with an agent,
mm-hmm.
like, oh, he just opened the door and got a commission, or, oh, that hurts me, you know, because there's a perception. So many people have had a bad experience with my profession because there's so many low value, low skill people out there doing it.
Yeah. I mean, you get compared to like a Chris Lindahl all the time, you know, with your, I would say your reach.
With my...
No, just kidding. I always bring that up. No, it is very true.
Yep.
And so at some point we had to say, just, you know, just trust in maybe the common sense of the athletes out there or the consumer.
Yep.
That they can kind of read between the tea leaves. But it's tough not to try and just beat your chest and go, no, look at the difference.
Yep.
Look at the difference. Because that can be a big piece there. And it's hard.
It is tricky. And you just feel bad when you're like, I'm technically on equal footing with this person who has no credentials. There's
yeah.
Yep.
And because there are, and again, it's difficult because you could have somebody who is a very smart, analytical, technically proficient coach and does not hold any of the certifications, doesn't even hold a USAT level one. And then you could have somebody who went through a USAT level one and it's a complete Nimrod. So just because they have the certification does not like make them to be the best. But I do think you have that there is a conversation that has to start somewhere.
Well, let's get real. If you're called a 20 to 25 year old middling professional athlete, Are you in a chapter of life when you're really listening to people? Because if you have a roster of 20 athletes,
yeah, you're not. You're,
your whole job
your
is to listen to them and respond.
Yeah, you're not listening to anybody else. And I think the farther along we go into, if we're just keeping in the triathlon space, the farther along we go into the sport, the fewer people we have that are coaching,
mm-hmm.
that come to coaching with a scientific, analytical background that don't have that have not gone down the path of education somewhere.
Yeah.
That needs to, I think it just kind of goes hand in hand. I think you 20 years ago, it was different because there wasn't the educational background set up. You had to come from a from many different sports. But now I think I think USAT education has to be an intrinsical part of the beginning of that journey, just to make sure that you're well enough rounded.
Yeah.
And you see that. And it's not just interaction and coaching with individuals. It's like how to run a business. You know, how to, you know, then you know that they're participating in programs like Safe Sport, which makes sure that you're not a predator. You're doing background checks. So you have,
which is another really dark side. I think more, a lot across the board in coaching, that's a dark side.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be malicious. I ran into this week a situation where I made an accusation, not an accusation. I made a statement on social media against another coach who took action or had an action against one of my Paralympic athletes that was pretty devastating to them emotionally. Had the conversation with them that they came to me and wanted to talk about it, which I was, hey, you know what? That's pretty big of you to do.
Yep.
Young coach, and determined that the actions that they had done that were so impactful were not, I don't think purposely malicious, but more stemming from a naive standpoint of like, wow, I never knew that would impact them.
Okay.
And so I think that what your basic educational standpoints with like USAT level one and going through Safe Sport, those would help mitigate some of those naive actions or statements that are being said. Like, you know,
that may inadvertently have an outsized negative impact.
Yeah. Understanding that you have with a younger athlete, an imbalance of power. You may make a suggestion that you talking to, like, let's say your spouse would be at an equal. It's a suggestion. And you expect that if they don't agree with it, they're going to say, nope, I don't agree with it. But if I make that, if I make that same suggestion to an athlete of mine who is, let's say, 17, they may not have the guts or the experience or the wherewithal to stand up to me and say no.
Yep.
And so then it becomes an influential piece. And that has been, you know, that influential standpoint, I think, has been understood more recently. But if you have not learned about it, gone through an educational process like in a level one or with Safe Sport, then you're not going to know that. And the only way you're going to find that out is you're going to kind of butt up against it and step in it. And that many times can ruin your career. If you're a public servant, they're going to throw you under the bus. And so hopefully it doesn't happen with this individual coach. I actually took the opportunity to appreciate their ability to say, I'm sorry, reach out, admit that what they did was probably not the right thing, and they didn't mean to. And well, then how do we move forward on
salute
that?
Salute to them for having the conversation,
the conversation. That was good because that was for me reassuring as somebody who is sub 30, under 30, saying in this day and age, I was, you know, not just going and just standing in the, you know, standing tall and going, no, I was right. And then making only the conversation through social media, they actually reached out and we had a human conversation. A lot of those things were very reassuring for me to say like, okay, that next generation of coaching has like, there is some potential. So, you know, that us Gen Xers who really set the bar way up here, you know,
that's funny that this, you know, salute to this individual for doing the grown-up thing. And whereas you've had in the last year a weird negative experience with more of a boomer coach in our space who is popping off on social media making nasty little comments against you out of the blue, but then having no human contact behind the scenes. So it's like not even a generational thing. It's like different people have these weird approaches.
Yeah, being trolled is it when you I've seen people be trolled. To actually be trolled and be accused of things in social media was like, I was taken aback. I think I called you immediately. I'm like, what? Like,
what does this? What, yeah, what, we
what
talked
I,
about.
What
it.
Did I do? And no. then trying to confront that, I actually reached out to this person because they, you know, I had. It's funny because I had actually taken a swim class from that coach.
Yeah.
Once in the very early days of my
so
racing,
probably 20 years ago,
like 35, 40 years ago, I yep. took a class, right?
Back when you were 30.
Back when I was, you know, back when in my 40s. But no, but then they would not engage back.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I felt like that was, you know, that was terrible. And so what do? You just,
unfall. Well, and when I shared what their life events are that I've heard about, it's like, yeah. Oh yeah, that's why it's, you might be a little upset right now.
Exactly. There's a little bit of scruff yep. in their background there. But you know, there's plenty of coaches coming out. I just think I'm not saying that I'm the best coach for any reason. I'm not saying you're the best coach for any reason, but I think as an athlete, I always inform athletes tell athletes be an informed consumer.
Yeah.
You know, don't just find somebody and go with them because of what you heard about them or because you know, they say that they're this. Have a conversation with them. See if you gel with them. It's like kind of like rushing a fraternity or a sorority. See if you have a camaraderie there because you're going to be working with them. And make sure that they're going to fit inside your wheelhouse of what you want to do, because you know you don't want a coach that says, oh, I'm only out here to train the best of the best.
The best of the best.
Well, elite.
I got tricked in my day. I was living too much online during my sporting career.
Yeah.
And tricked myself into thinking, oh, okay, I need to step it up. So not it. I'm talking about the other end of the spectrum from the pro who does a coach as a backup to a pro coach, a coach of professionals. So this was a guy who'd been a national team coach for one or two prominent nations and then had this little cluster, this training group that he brought around the world with that was focused on the Olympics. And then he subsidized his international high-flying lifestyle off chumps, paying the premium for remote coaching. So his real athletes, he was very focused and very dedicated on them, and many of them produced big results.
Yep.
But he was lining his pockets. I was paying this dude $500 a month at a time when I had
no money.
$100 a month.
Yeah.
And so it really...
How long were you with him?
18 months. I paid about 10 grand over the course of my tenure with him to get slower, tired, depressed, and...
How far into that did you first start questioning whether you should cut bait or not?
We started in late 2011. We rolled through the 2012 season. 2012, I had some big hits and some big misses. Going into the coaching relationship, I said, my North Stars, I want to run faster. I want to be more consistent. I want to feel way more regimented and, you know, way more dialed in, be more professional. 2012, I had some massive ups and downs. I had some of my best runs, but also some huge flubs and huge misses. So it was, I feel silly in retrospect, ending our first full year together, going out of 2012 into 13, I was looking at it like, well, here were the North Star objectives I set for this coaching relationship. Let's see, consistency, didn't hit that. Running faster, sometimes hit that, sometimes not. We failed. I should have looked at it like objectively, hey, we failed. What are we going to do different for 2013? I didn't. We just kept it rolling. And in the middle of 2013, we had continued to increase my training load. In theory, I think if I kept at the training load for a longer period, I may have adapted and absorbed it and maybe could have kept it pushing. But by the middle of 2013, I've slowed down. I'm way less consistent. I'm doing all this work. From the point I was at going in where I can maybe squeak out a paycheck or something from a pro race a year, into 2013, I didn't get a single paycheck as a pro, I don't think. So it's like, okay, well, what? I'm slower. I'm doing more work. I'm tired. What if it became an identity crisis? Like, what am I doing with my life here?
Yeah.
Because there's no point in keeping on a path. There was no clear outcome without like 2 more years of burying myself with 30-hour weeks.
So looking back, you probably should have broke up earlier.
Looking back,
what was the line in the sand for you? Because it seems like you had told yourself enough things to like, it's going to be better. It's going to be okay. Almost yeah. like, okay, well, they cheated on me once. I'm going to still stick with them because I think they're a good person at heart. What yeah. was it?
Mid season 2013, it was July. It was just all coming apart. I'd had a a couple of really brutal events in both June and July of that year. It was just a depressing weekend. I drove alone to race in Muncie, Indiana. So hour, you know, so long in the car to race in the butthole of the Midwest. I swam with the lead group, lost them going into T1, weirdly, kind of just like get a little bit gap from a couple of the guys. Rode mediocre, ran super mediocre. Finish at 1 p.m. like, cool, I accomplished so little here. I'm going to drive home for like 11 hours. Fun. It was like a really dark moment.
Yeah.
And so I was just reeling coming out of that. And I was having like a little meltdown. And, you know, we just were exchanging emails. And it's like, okay, we're done.
You're not getting it.
We're just done.
Yeah. I mean, you're the epitome of how a coach-athlete relationship is really a relationship. Accountability.
The tough thing understanding. Was, in that relationship, I'm paying the Uber premium for his name brand. Oh, you would think we were doing a biweekly phone call. No, we talked maybe twice a year.
So what could he have done to have kept you motivated and still trying to work towards some sort of more like maybe realistic goal or progressive goal? Is there anything that he could have done? You thinking about how you coach,
yep,
and what you as an athlete, what could he have done to change that?
We would have had conversations going into races, setting specific benchmarks, talking through. There were all manner of details where it's like, oh, well, here's who's in the field, or here's what's the specifics of the events. Here's what you need to focus on, Devin. Here's your specific goals. Here's I want you to go out and get. Chris, there was nothing. There was no communication. So looking back, it's like, did I fail in many of my duties as an athlete to push back or to give more detailed feedback or to initiate more conversations? Yep, I certainly could have been way more proactive. So I'm not completely blaming the other party. It's like, it takes two to tango.
Yep.
But when I look at the premium that was paid and the service that was rendered, it's like, oh, yeah, I was subsidizing a lifestyle.
Yeah, it's true. And probably shame on you for a little bit for not, yep, you know, 100%. For sticking with it. Shame on them for maybe just milking you,
yep,
or you know, or taking advantage of you in this situation, especially from a financial standpoint, and them knowing what kind of a burden that is, unfortunately, because there are a number of pros who just kind of want to live that lifestyle, but, you know, never are good.
Yep.
You know, never have been good and never will be good.
Filler.
Yeah. They're the 50 through 63 at Oceanside. Right.
And part of the reason I was losing it mentally at that time is my excitement for triathlon started when I could win races.
Yeah.
So to be moving further into my pro career and almost getting further from winning or accomplishing anything, it was like, what is the point of this? What am I doing here? Because there's no money. If I'm not at least excited or winning something, what the heck are we doing here?
Yeah. And the attraction of being a pro wasn't enough for it.
Yeah. I mean, once you're in the reality, it's like, what does pro mean? What does being a coach mean? What does the word realtor mean? It's like when you realize how low the barrier to entry is. With triathlon, the barrier to entry to be a pro is, there's no barrier. If you're a halfway decent athlete, you can find a technicality and go get that pro card.
So it's not so much getting into it. It's what you do with it once you're there.
Yep. 100%.
I think that's kind of the moral of the story. You know, you can be a realtor, you can be a really good one. You can be an advocate. You can be a helpful person, be the best you can. You can make like you make the content and things that you make and how, you know, I think you give a good service point to many of the people out there. I think that sets you apart. And that says, once I got here, this is what I'm doing and how I'm making this a better experience. You feel a sense of pride in what you do.
100%.
Same with coaching. It's like once you get in there, you know, I realize that I have a niche. I'm helping people and I'm trying to do the best I can inside the avenue that I have to work with and be happy with that.
Yep.
And sometimes it's not about the money. Actually, it's like, you know, it's not about the money. Bobby McGee, who is one of my coaching mentors, once said, you coach for at least 5 years and you pay to coach.
Yeah.
You don't get paid. You pay to coach. That's what you're not making money. And even now, Joe would love for me to make bank. I don't make bank. There's nothing in this. I do this for so many other reasons outside of making money.
But the more focused you are on doing an elite job of serving,
Yeah.
The more it opens the door to financial reward down the road.
I think at some point, you know, I think there will be, there always are doors that open up. I like I said, I've said it 100 times. I stumble into more stuff than I ever purposely trying to walk into. And that probably is part of just being a genuine person.
Yep.
And saying, okay, I'm trying to do this for the right reasons. And I'm trying to do this for the best reasons. It's a long-term thing and it's not something you can goal for, but I also think being a good human being, there's a bit of karma.
Yep.
Right. And there, that good coaching karma, good real estate agent karma comes from just being a good person. You may not be able to plan on that paying off, but you know that somewhere down the line, it's going to.
Yes. Well, having a good heart, being easy to work with, makes a huge difference because you see certainly in real estate, and we both know in coaching, some of the egos or the prima donnas.
Oh, it's yes.
Like, no one would ever choose to collaborate with you because you're so painful to deal with.
Yeah. And other people try and buy their way into it.
Yep.
You know, it's like, okay, well, I've got all the best things. I've got all the best equipment. I've got the most money backing me. Doesn't mean you're going to be the best because I've run down that road before.
Oh, yeah.
And I've seen that happen. And it still happens today.
Yep.
You know, well, this is flashy. This is so new. This is great. This is like, well, it doesn't mean you're the best. Doesn't mean well, you're even adequate.
And it doesn't mean it's going to make tech's only as good as you implement it. And you see some of the flashy on the coaching side, some of the flashy stuff you can go out and get. It's like, will this make a single bit of difference for my athletes?
No.
I think of bike fitting.
Yep.
Our guy, Chris Balzer, in town. I just had a fit with Chris where he made a tweak like, hey, Devin, here's what we're going to do with your fit. And here's what I want you to think about with muscle recruitment and as you're pedaling. I've been riding pretty seriously since 2007. This guy makes a suggestion and it almost redefined the way I'm riding right now. It's like, oh my God.
That's awesome.
So very few people would I have put on a pedestal where I'm actually going to listen to them when they make a suggestion like that.
Yeah.
But it's like, he has earned that. And so a lot of people can go buy the most expensive bike fitting system. That doesn't mean they're going to bring the value that a Chris Balzer of Bike Fit Guru can bring.
No. I mean, Chris does use all that. Chris uses technology.
Yep.
But he doesn't use it as a crutch. He uses it as a way to see things that he can't see with his naked eye.
Yep.
And then he knows how to change those things. And I think that's from coaches is also like, I look at my desk here, which is unbelievably cluttered, but I have, you know, I've got 3 boxes sitting here. One is the Wahoo Element, you know, so like bike information that I need to be able to see. I can see it, but how do I apply it and how do I understand it?
Yep.
You know, the other one that I got the Form 2 goggles. Those.
Yeah.
And those are, there's so much data that comes from that. And I've become a huge fanboy of what that has allowed me to see through my athletes as a coach and being able to coach at a next level and being kind of in the eye of a coach of a mm-hmm. swimmer at all points and times. And then this is NIX hydration monitor, which is it looks like a CGI, continuous glucose, or CGM, continuous glucose monitor patch. Mm-hmm. And it works off of Bluetooth, but it monitors how much you sweat and what the content of your sweat is. And then it gives you a breakdown of what that is. And so you can start to make plans. And so if you're trying to, and I'm doing with Nopes coming up here, is Nopes is doing Ironman.
Yep.
And we're working together. I'm coaching him now, by the way.
I know.
So we're going to be, we have a strategic plan of having.
Mutual client of ours.
Mutual client. You don't coach Nopes, but you.
No.
but you guys race together as MJets. That's the history there. And did you help him buy his house?
Wouldn't care to say. Confidentiality.
Okay, confidentiality. Can't say that. But what we're going to be doing is doing testing with that hydration patch so we can be nail down what his hydration needs are at specific temperatures and exertion rates. Which, especially for him, has been a huge, like, I would say, question mark. He hasn't been able to really identify that. And he brought that into our conversation initially when we started, was, this is something I need to know more about. And there have been those things out there. But you could just trust this, or you can learn from it and be able to apply it. How do you apply that knowledge? Because this doesn't just say, okay, you need to do X, Y, or Z. Because if it did, then you wouldn't need a coach.
Yep.
But that's a big change these days, is knowing how to balance out like what is worthwhile information and what's worthless information. Kind of like, is it, you know, doing one VO2 max test informational? Yes. Is doing one a month, like you might go to a popular national fitness club here in the United States and in Minnesota, that would tell you you need to test every month on that? Nope, that's not necessarily.
Is that more of a, is that for physiology reasons or sales reasons?
That's 100% for sales reasons, yeah. There, sir. But it's a big piece of what you have to kind of keep up with. Yep. You didn't have to know a lot of those things. Maybe 25 years ago, but there were other things that you had to be aware of because,
This hydration tool opens a lot of doors. These pros who are complaining about Singapore.
Yeah.
Well, get calibrated. Yep. Use that as your calibration tool. Like, oh, I need X liters and it has to have X concentration of electrolyte.
100%. And it's a pretty interesting thing. I just started experimenting on it with myself,
mm-hmm.
Understanding that I'm losing 29 ounces of fluid per hour playing hockey, which is an interesting thing because you're indoors in a controlled atmosphere. So I'm interested to see how that relates to riding when we ride outdoors in the heat, how that's going to change and how it's going to modulate the need and the concentration of electrolytes that are being lost. Pretty interesting stuff. So, those are the things that I think, as a coach, you need to really embrace and be able to lean into and know how to apply.
Yeah.
So, anything else, Devin, you can think of for today?
Nope. I'm over here with soda.
You're over here. Yeah. Soda is completely asleep. And, if you ever saw it. Well, if you follow Devin on social media, what is your Instagram handle?
Chris, that's a great question.
You don't even know your Instagram handle.
Let's look
that up quick. While you're looking that up, I will tell you, or we'll tell everybody that's listening.
Devin Palmer MSP.
Devin Palmer MSP. All lowercase. No spaces.
You can also follow MSP Moves at MSP Moves. That's my company page.
Oh, there you go. All good.
All good things.
If you are listening and you are a new coach, or if you're looking to become a coach, two things that we offer here, because we don't just say things and not help back it up. I do offer a mentorship program where I work with coaches individually, like I would with an athlete, to help them become a better coach one-on-one. And there is defined programs that I do that with that are supplemental to the USAT coaching education that we do. That's one thing. One is an option. Also, if you are a coach and, we bring people in and we hire coaches that work inside our consortium here at Final K, if it's something you're looking to do and you're interested in, we'd love to hear from you because not necessarily we're looking to hire, but we are always looking to add to our quiver of people that want to learn and want to cooperate in a group.
I think the sales pitch for joining Final K is if you're kind of coaching part-time and it's like something in the periphery that you really enjoy the coaching side, well, coaching isn't just coaching, it's building a business. So if you're not a skilled salesperson, if you don't want to be a marketer, if you don't want to deal with billing,
you want to focus on the craft.
If you want to focus on the craft coming under the umbrella, that's obviously the pitch there.
There are a lot of organizations that'll take you on and then like bleed you dry.
Yeah.
And I've seen those out there. We don't do that.
Yeah.
We also don't take everybody under the sun as well, because very much like the disclaimer that I told my son and all of his friends that ride with us to hockey, no one likes a dick.
Nope.
Whether it's on your phone or it's on your line at hockey or in your coaching quiver. No one likes a dick.
Yeah.
All right. Devin.
What a note to go out on there, Chris.
I know. Isn't that crazy? Isn't that crazy? There's a whole big thing that my sister-in-law, Allie, and I have talked about on that one. Devin, what a great time today. We went through a lot of things. I really appreciate you coming over.
My pleasure.
Even though it was earlier than you thought and anticipated.
Whoops.
Well, and you know what? We got to ride here soon.
We do.
We definitely have to get riding.
One of us is already riding.
I saw that. I saw that. But I've got to get out riding with
you.
Yes,
you do.
But we got to do it at the right time. And we also have to find a new bridge to go over, because I believe our bridge is...
Did they shut it down again?
It's going to be gone for the summertime. So we got to figure out a secondary route to bridge our two great cities. Our two great cities need a bridge. Because we lived through the bridge between the VA, but now our beloved Mendota Bridge is going to be out of service. And one of us might have to learn to swim. Or we'll meet at the Smith Bridge. Or the Ford Bridge. Who knows? We're going to have to incorporate a new bridge into our ride route. But hey, if you're out there and you see two middle-aged guys that look like one's half wheel and the other.
You said one cool, strong millennial realtor and one Gen X kind of hockey looking dad guy. Yep. That's us.
That's getting half wheeled by the real cool realtor looking guy. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's us out there. Make sure you say hi, and if you do drive by us, throw a little chirp and just let us know that we next time can be just a little better. Take care, everybody. Bye.